The Business of Life, brought to you by Country Harvest Meet the Breadwinners podcast, available wherever you listen to podcasts. La, la, la.
Welcome to The Business of Life. I'm Jan Arden. I'm here in studio in Calgary, Alberta, Canada with Arlene Dickinson. Yay! It's nice to when we do this face-to-face. We've been lucky because our last couple we did face-to-face in Toronto. So none of us are in a remote, exotic location.
No, we're the only time we can get together in the same place is in either Toronto or Calgary.
Yeah.
But you know, I was thinking as I was driving here this morning, you know, having lived in Calgary for almost 55, 57 years.
No, were you here that long?
Yeah, maybe more.
Just
Which
is weird because Arlene's 43 years old.
I know, it's amazing.
So I don't even know how she's doing her math.
It's time travel. I go backwards.
Me too.
I have lived in Calgary for 56 years. And I, in fact, I remember when
lots
we came to Calgary, the Palliser Hotel was the tallest building in the city. So it's really changed. But every time I am here home, I am struck by the beauty of this city. It is really
the backdrop
such, it's just
of
really,
those mountains.
It's clean. People are friendly. I always say doing business here is so much. It's just such, it's more of a pleasure to do business here.
It's quite civilized,
isn't
it?
It's civilized. People are, you know, they're saying, why should, you know, let's do business together, not, you know, where did you come from? Where did you go to university? You know, who are your friends? Like sometimes in some of the other larger cities whose names will go unmentioned in Canada, the approach is more about who you are versus what you can do for somebody. It's really, yeah, it's very interesting. But having said that, I also really do love, you know, the East as well. But Calgary is home, and every time I come here, I have this deep sense of connection to the city. I love it. I really do. And people, if you haven't been to Calgary, come visit. It's a great city. It's much more than the Stampede.
It's
probably
going to
get
more,
me in trouble, but
no,
it is
but
way more than the Stampede.
It's much more than that. And it's much more than cattle. It's much more than petroleum. It's, you know, it's very tech-savvy. I mean, Calgary in particular has got a lot of software stuff happening here. They've got a lot of technological stuff happening here. They've got, you know, it's a young city. There's more restaurants per capita in Calgary than any other city in North America.
And I think it's the youngest city in Canada, demographic-wise. I think we have the youngest population.
People are staying here.
It's more than technology. I mean, yes, it is technology. But, you know, I've got a bit of a beef about that.
Okay, let's do it.
See
what you did there?
Yeah, what I did there? Is that, you know, technology is great, but we are much more than technology. Like, we have an enormous agricultural base, an enormous healthcare base. Like, there's a lot of really smart people.
You're doing a lot of food stuff out of here now
with our accelerator.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not just saying that because I'm in that space, although I am, you know, sure, let's talk
about
that.
No, but I'm just saying there's a lot of young entrepreneurs here in Calgary, in Alberta, that are doing all kinds of innovative food things,
yeah,
and that really thinking forward stuff, like vegan, even cosmetics,
mm-hmm,
plant-based cosmetics, a lot of vegan, like fast foods, like that mac and cheese,
mm-hmm,
made with lentils and chickpeas that I tried, chickpea pasta.
Yeah.
And no, they're not our sponsors, but I'm going to give them a little shout out, yeah, because it's so good. It's lentils and chickpeas, and I swear to you, if no one had told me that, there's a cheese. They have a vegan version.
Mm-hmm.
Very clever.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems so cheesy. Whenever I'm eating it, I'm like, am I eating like cheddar, melted cheddar cheese? It's really good. So shout out to them.
Oh, thank you.
Innovative product, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I you know what? But I think the thing about Calgary, you know, having gone through a lot of recessionary periods in this city.
We're still in
it,
aren't we?
Yeah, we definitely are still in it. And it can be very boom and bust. And I think, you know, we talk about how entrepreneurial we are in the city. But I think we need to... we need to be prepared to think about other industries to try and diversify the economy. We talk about it all the time, but it doesn't really happen.
People don't want to budge.
Yeah, there's
they want what they want.
In life
they
and
want
in
what
business.
They know.
It's
yeah,
true.
You know, it's funny when you think back to the turn of the century. You know, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. You know, you see all these guys, these family men, with the horses and the carts that are bringing the milk, that are delivering the goods, that are hauling off garbage, that are doing everything with a horse and buggy of some description. And then the car comes along. You know, Mr. Ford comes along. And
the train came
all
along.
These guys, and the trains, yes. But it's like they did not want to budge. And they said, it's a phase. This car thing's never going to
last. Yeah, it's never going to last.
It's never going to last. Well, then they had to change. And people are like, well, what are you going to do with all the horses? Shoot them? I'm like, no. They'll probably just, you know, find other things. They'll be in a field somewhere having a good life. But change will come.
Yeah.
And I think the consumer always has the last word. You would know more about that than me, but the consumer has the last word about change.
The consumer's changing. What have you been up to this week?
I have had a really interesting week. Anyone following along on my social media, I've been picking up my parents' 2,400 square foot home that was built on my property. And they've cut it in two pieces. I know I've been speaking about this ad nauseum, but now it is up on wheels. So yesterday there was a huge crew there kind of cleaning up around it. And on Monday morning, the power lines come down on my road, all their permits kick in, and this house and its garage will be on a different truck are going down the road. They're going on a four-day excursion to take this house, I'm going to say about 60 kilometers.
How do you feel about it?
Very bittersweet. I've cried myself out about it. Yeah. And, you know, you just let it go. Talking about change. Talk about recycling. I mean, someone is going to live in that home. A family bought it. I want to say Water Valley. And they're putting it on the exact basement print that Dad and Mom had. And they went down there and they took out windows, walls, floorboards, everything they could salvage out of that basement because it will all be caved in.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the house goes down the road. I've been doing that. Haven't been doing it. I've just been watching them do it. I'm like, how do you jack it up? It's so clever.
So they cut it in half and they put it back together.
Well, the garage is just a small piece of it, but it would have made it too wide to take down any road, had to be taken off. But it is a two-story home.
Tell me, is it cheaper to do that? What do you sell a house for?
Well, I'm not going to say what I sold it for, but let's just put it very, very inexpensively. What it costs them is a lot of money. I can only speculate.
Yeah.
You
don't know. Yeah.
So the company, the McCann brothers or the McCann movers that are undertaking this, you know, I think it's a huge expense to them. I mean, they've had guys in my yard off and on for a month, and just the trucking, the permits, getting it there. And the people do buy the house, and I think that's where they make a little bit of money. I don't think it's a lot. The people that bought the house are going to have to do triage. They're going to have to repaint, fix the drywall. There's going to be
all
creaks
the cracks
and cricks
and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, to get it there.
Huh, but it's still a very cool way to reuse a home. It's more
and
cost
it's
efficient.
Way you couldn't build it for that.
Yeah, it's very cool. Like I was actually just more curious. Not what you sold the house for, but what it cost to actually move the house.
I'll tell you what.
Yeah, I bet it's interesting.
I don't know all the numbers, but it was really dumbfounding to me to rip Mom and Dad's house down and recycle it in a way that companies would come in, take ceiling tiles, take lighting fixtures, appliances, like take what they could
salvage.
It was way more expensive for me to do that. I wouldn't have come out of it. This way, it's almost a moot point. I'm going to probably spend, you know, 15, 20 grand, not this summer, but over the next year on landscaping, putting trees. That spot's going to sink because they fill it in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to sink for, I would say, 2 or 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. It's just going to settle. So I'm going to keep having a divot. Mm-hmm. Everyone's like, just put a liner in the basement and make a pool. Can you imagine swimming through the bedrooms? Hi, this used to be spare bedroom
one.
Yeah,
that's not, that would be a little.
But yeah, bittersweet. It is going to be so weird. They've already picked it up and moved it 30 feet onto Mom and Dad's front yard. So it's sitting up on these massive tires like a trailer. And they'll hook it up, and my fence has to come down on Sunday, and then it goes down the road.
It's crazy.
It'll be like an epic Jan's Road picture, and of course, I'm not home. I have a charity thing that day.
Yeah.
So my assistant, Nadine's going to take pictures like crazy. And that's what I've been doing, and I've been writing. I'm working on another book, and my deadline moved up slightly, so I have to have it kind of handed in by second week of August.
My next book's coming out soon.
Look at it. We're just like...
Yeah, we're like... it's very funny when you say things like, how do we... Because honestly, everyone, we do not plan this stuff.
No.
We never know what the other one's doing until we talk.
When does it come out?
It comes out in November.
Great. And what's this one called?
This book is on reinvention and how you can reinvent yourself. It's a book that's focused on really the notion that you know, the power to change is within us.
Oh, I love
that. Talking
about
change and how you can reinvent yourself. Because I think at a time where everyone's worried about all the evolving and changing things around them and feeling that they either can't keep up with it because they're...
Or they're getting left behind.
They're getting left behind, mm-hmm. or it's moving so fast they don't understand it, or I can't write code, so ergo I can't do anything. You know, there's so many things like that that I feel like it's a topic that we all can relate to. And it was a real journey for me writing the book, Jen. It was a real journey, you know, reinvention, the notion of how you can take yourself and become somebody and take the best of yourself, take the core of who
people
you are.
People always say, how do you find time?
Yes. Yeah.
And ironically, that's probably part of reinvention. You have to make the time for yourself in a world that's gone crazy. So even sitting down, taking the time to write the book, to get that structure down, that's a reinvention in a way, because you have to reconfigure Arlene Dickinson's life.
Yeah. Well, and you, if you don't, you know, and I think the problem is that most of us are afraid of reinvention.
Why?
Because we're afraid of what it means. We're afraid of changing who we are or taking people's expectations of us and becoming something different than what people expect us to be or what we see ourselves as. You know, what's that saying? You know, we're afraid of our own greatness in many respects.
And I think afraid of succeeding.
Yeah, we're afraid of. And I think the reality is that sometimes you don't reinvent until you get forced into it. You know, you go through a divorce, you go through a death, you go through an illness, you go through losing your job, you go through
that push aging. Over the
There's
cliff.
That push that either you actually pick yourself up and say, I've got to reassess and go through a process, which is what the book does. It takes you through that process of how you do this and how it can be successful for you. So,
oh, I can't wait to read it.
It's HarperCollins. Well, I'm very excited.
Maybe I'll get an advance copy.
Maybe. I'm pretty sure I can organize that. So I'm excited about that. I'm excited that you're writing another one. What's yours going to be on?
Well, we're going to come back and I'm going to tell you all about that.
Okay. Welcome back, everybody, to The Business of Life. Jan and I are talking about
one of the top 10 podcasts consistently in the country. So if you're listening right now, thank you.
Yes, thank you so much. We were actually top 3, I think. It was a big deal. Yeah, thank you, everybody. And you helped me through my insecurities, the last episode where I was talking about the bad reviews, the 2 bad reviews we got.
Well, that coupled with the farmers not showing up to take you out, Arlene Dickinson had a very difficult 15 days, ladies and gentlemen. We're still waiting for farmers. Farmers are, how about, you know what, maybe we should go into like more of the, what is that Christian dating service? Is it like, what's that called?
There's a Christian. Warren? There's a Christian dating service.
Warren is our producer sitting right beside us.
Warren, what is it, Warren?
Christian Mingle.
Christian Mingle. Christian Mingle. Life. I was going to say
we're
Christian.
We're both yelling. It's Christian Mingle.
Mingle. Christian Mingle.
Like, what does that even mean? Anyway, sorry to skip ahead.
I want to ask you about your book. Yeah, let's go back. We get easily distracted. Tell me about Tell me about your upcoming book.
Well, I'm not going to tell you the whole nine yards, but
what's the premise?
Random House kind of wanted a companion book to Feeding My Mother, which was sort of about the journey I took with my mom. Well, through that journey, because my mom started with Alzheimer's like 10, 11, 12 years ago, you know, I walked into a new decade.
Yeah.
I walked from my 40s into my 50s.
Yeah.
Big difference.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of changes in me psychologically, mentally, physically, emotionally. I feel like I finally was able to apply lessons that I've learned in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what this book is about. It's about being a certain age, feeling like, you know, suddenly, you know, women are marginalized, they're somehow their sexuality is shelved because they're not of, childbearing ages. All those things that happen to women, or what women do to themselves,
the
to say,
we talk about.
I'm out of the game now, and I'm going to put my dreams in a box, and I'm going to put my hopes and my wishes and things that I wanted to start doing. And for some reason, people hit 55, and they're like, no, let's get the golf clubs out, and let's, I mean, that's fine too. Mm. But I mean, I want to encourage women, especially when they hit 50, you're walking into your power. You're walking into a time in your life that
that's kind of the same.
And that's what it is. And I found myself writing a lot about my dad and how my parents affected my decision making, the lessons that I'm able to see now. Like, my dad was a terrible parent, but I'm able to look back now and go,
he did the best.
Was he terrible?
He did the best he could.
He did the best he could. And I talk a lot about that. So it's been a good, it's been a catalyst for me to really think about how the changes I've made and why. So, yeah, it's about power.
That is what, you know, writing a book is an incredibly meaningful experience, because you really do have to do a lot of self-examination. You have to understand the lessons you've learned, why you learned them, what the point in time was that you were going through, and things that you were experiencing, and how it impacted you. And it's a very... You know, I would encourage everybody to keep a journal. I think journal keeping.
Write it down.
Write it down, or do a voice note, or do, you know, whatever the technology that you're good at. But keep a journal, because it gives you a sense of...
When you say things out loud, right? Or write them down and see them on paper.
It encourages you to then...
It lets you
to
move
do
on.
What, exactly. And that's... My book talks a lot about that. But you're about... You'll be... So my book comes out in November. You're going to be at least a year before your book comes out.
I don't think it'll be 2020 because if I'm delivering August 12th, then it's it takes a lot of setup, folks. It's like the artwork, you know, the editing process. I work with an amazing woman named Ann Collins.
Yeah. I've heard of Ann. I think I've met Ann. Did she not do Lisa Gabriel's books as well? I think she might have with The Winters. And Lisa did
The Winters. I just read The Winters.
And she's such a fantastic author.
It was
too.
Such a terrific book.
Shout out to you, Lisa.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
It was a chilling book. I see that being either a six-part BBC miniseries or a fantastical movie, because it was nail-biting.
Yes.
I'm like, is this seriously going to happen? If you haven't read The Winters, you should read The Winters.
Yeah.
But
Lisa's very talented. She's a very talented... We have so many great talented
writers here.
Writers in Canada.
The novelists, the nonfiction writers. There's so many. There's just so many. I can't even start naming them. And I do try and focus on Canadian writers. Like, I'm one of those people, whenever the Giller comes up, you know, I'm like, oh, I want to see what books are on the docket. And it's something that I'm really interested in. And honestly, reading has shaped my life.
Yeah, and as an author, I will tell you that, you know, there's something really...
Are you following along with us, everybody? Because we're switching gears here.
No, we're still on books.
Yeah.
Glad
I wanted to talk about books today.
Because I think books are such a... important books actually found a form. Books formed me. I you know, if I can say, like, life shaped me, but there's a lot
tell
of what
me
I
why.
Learned in books.
And what books in particular,
you know, and I would say that I don't have people say, you know, which books, but
have a favorite?
When I was growing up, I read everything.
The Nancy Drew stuff.
The bookmobile would roll up in front of our neighborhood.
Do they still have that?
I think in some remote areas they do, and I loved the bookmobile. I loved it because you'd walk on board, and you'd walk onto this bus. Everybody, it was a mobile library, and it would go to areas that didn't have libraries yet built in them. And we lived in an area that was a fairly new area, and it didn't have a library yet. And you would go out, and you'd walk onto this bus, and you would have, you know, I think they gave you a certain time limit on the bus. You couldn't look forever, because there was always people waiting to get on, and the bus could only hold so many. And you'd get on, and it smelt of that library sense, you know, the
paper
smell
and
of
ink
paper
and, yep.
and ink and the covers. And you would pull out books, and you would, you know, whether it was Wuthering Heights or whether it was Catcher in the Rye, or, you know, whether it was Nancy Drew, you know, or whether it was just, you know, a travel book where you could learn about kind of what was going on with travel. There was so many. I mean, honestly, as you say that, I can think of a dozen books that go fill my head and my heart of things that I read as a youth that actually helped me realize that there was a world outside of my world, that there was so much that was possible. And these books were the escape. I mean, now we have internet and we can go anywhere, but these books actually
created...
But you
can download books now from anywhere.
But people don't... I don't think people read books the same as they used to. And I'd like to talk about that, because I think our attention span is getting shorter and shorter and shorter, and we're not really paying attention to the wisdom of what the written word can give us. So let's come back to that. La, 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 la,
la, la, la. And And I was just saying to Arlene that I love posting on Twitter. I'm a list person. Like a lot of my favorite journalists out there will write 15 books you need to read once in your life, or the 25 scariest books that you haven't read. And I'm always interested in the lists, and I click onto them and I'm like, read that one. Ooh, haven't read that. So last night, the 15 books that you must read at some point in your life are absolutely books that probably deal with the last 200 years of literature, like when modern literature really took root. Well, there's a book by George Eliot. George Eliot was a pseudonym. I forget what her actual name was, but she, women authors weren't really readily accepted or read or as popular as male authors, so she called herself George Eliot. Maybe Warren can look that up for us. But anyways, this book is this epic book called Middlemarch, and it is 900 pages, and it's very much in the vein of you know, Sense and Sensibility, the Jane Austen stuff, George Eliot. Anyway,
well, George Eliot was a guy, but his pen name was Marianne Evans. So,
no.
He was a man who wrote as a woman.
What?
Yes. I just looked it up, or Ward actually looked it up and showed us. Sir George Eliot. That's pretty interesting.
That's impossible.
Well, yeah. Oh, no. Wait. Now it says marriage to John Cross Odessa. Maybe it was a female.
No, it was. That was her name. Yeah. She changed her name to George Eliot.
But the other one, it said.
I don't know.
Something's wrong here.
No, I'm serious. It was a female.
It was a female. I take it all back.
Yes.
Warren clicked on fake news. Fake news, Warren.
I'm sorry.
Oh, look how beautiful she was.
Marianne's name escaped me, but Marianne wrote under George Eliot.
Okay.
And but anyway, Middlemarch. So I read 100 pages last night. Okay. It is so fascinating. I mean, the way that they constructed sentences, we actually talk like a bunch of morons. I mean, where English has gotten to, and I probably sound really mean right now, but when I look at the construct of how they put sentences together and how they describe things, it is, my mind is just like spinning.
And did you ever read Out of Africa
or
Roots? Like Out of Africa is, when you talk about the meaning of people's words and their ability to articulate and put into paper, if you really just think about it, you're reading
out
something.
Out of Africa was a Dickinson. She was a Scandinavian writer, wasn't she?
Out of Africa
or maybe she was an African.
Roots was written by Alex Haley.
Yes, I did read that. I read that
out
in high school.
Out of Africa was written by Karen Blixen.
Oh, Blixen.
Anyway, it was an amazing book. But my point was going to be, if I can finish it here and get this,
we will.
This thought out.
We have a point.
My point is that isn't it amazing that words on a page, literally it is ink on a page, can take you into a journey of your mind, into the theater of your mind, and you can be in Africa, you can be in Thailand, you can be in a bedroom with somebody, you can be in a, you know, at a dinner party, you can experience the love, the joy, the hate, the fear.
You're right in it. You forget your reading.
You forget your reading, and that's the beauty of the written word. And I fear that we're losing some of that sense
of
storytelling.
We are.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah,
I agree.
You don't see kids with books anymore.
But when you do, it's magical. Like sitting cross-legged at an airport. I was going somewhere last week, and this woman had her three kids with her. And they looked like they were, I'm terrible with ages, but I'm going to say 4, 7, and 10, kind of like in there. They were all sitting cross-legged against the wall, reading books. And she was on her phone. She was on her phone doing her thing.
Yeah, of course, the mom's on her phone.
But her kids were reading the books. And the one book that the girl was reading, the middle girl, I was like, I actually dug my glasses out of my purse, put them on because I wanted to see what she was reading. I kind of saw it. And my heart lit up because it was an Enid Blyton book.
Oh.
Enid Blyton. And she was an English writer. And I read all her books. When I was a kid, anything that she had written. And she was quite famous in her little hometown. And my friend Nigel, who I've spoken about many times, took me to where she lived and showed me the building where she wrote her books.
That's awesome.
This was like last year. And honest to God, Arlene, It was like you could showed me the crown jewels. I stood in front of that building and I said to Nigel, Enid Blyton wrote the books above this store. He goes, yes, for God's sakes.
Have you read Chris Hadfield's book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life?
No.
That you need to read that book. It's really well written. It's such a, again, a really, another story, another Canadian who, you know, who's been like, who's been in space and who actually created a whole new genre of astronaut relative to kind of his connection back to Earth. He was recording music. He was writing. He was doing so many really cool things to get kids interested in space and astrophysics.
Can I brag a bit?
Can you
Can I brag a little bit?
Sure.
About him?
Yeah. Brag. Did you date him? No, he's married.
No, I did not date him.
No, I'm kidding.
No,
what do you want to brag? What do you want to brag about?
Well, when he was on the space station, I was contacted through NASA, through my office, and Chris was kind enough. He put me on a list of Canadians that he wanted to speak to via satellite. Yeah. There was only a certain amount of time I could speak to him because of the way that the space shuttle was going, or not space shuttle, the space station. Anyway, I downloaded a special app from NASA and I tested with their people, and then Chris popped up and I was allowed to ask him anything that I wanted.
Oh, how cool. That's bragging.
Then,
that's not bragging.
And
that's
I had
so
Dad
cool.
come over.
Yeah.
And my dad came over because I said, I'm going to be talking to Chris Hadfield and on the iPad. He just couldn't get over it. But my dad was in behind me, like his face kind of drifted into the camera, and Chris is like, who's that there behind you? And I said, that's my dad. And he said hi to my dad and everything. And
what'd you ask him?
My dad, well, he said, you know, I know what you're going to ask me. And I'm like, yeah, I want to know how you guys go to the bathroom.
Yep.
And he goes, Jan, I get asked that all the time. And we're all dumbfounded by the weightlessness.
Yeah.
Obviously, you can't flush a toilet. And it's, you know, it was interesting to me. But he showed me, walked me through there. He's floating through. The camera's going along with him. And he's showing us everything. It was absolutely magical.
Yeah. No,
so I'm going to read that.
Yeah, read it. Read the book. Because now you have a personal connection to him.
So his perspective must have been so different from looking down at a planet, you know, for all those months. Our problems must have seemed so insignificant when you're looking down at all these lights and the unity of a planet. You don't see borders when you're in space. You don't see ethnicity. You just see lights, these beautiful lights.
You see the physical presence of a planet. And I think you understand the possibility of what's out there and how mankind can live, you know, potentially, you know, populate the moon, go to Mars, do, you know, like the universe is so big and we are so insignificantly small in the context of things. But we are, as far as we know right now, the only human race. But there could be other, I can't imagine that there aren't. I can't even begin to believe that there aren't.
To me, that's an impossibility. I can't even fathom that there wouldn't be other forms of life out there. It just seems impossible to me that the universe is ever expanding. I mean, there's things billions of light years away from us. Billions of light years.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was me knocking on the
table.
Do you ever get
when you think about what's possible with all the planets and all the...
I get very anxious.
You do?
Oh, yeah.
Why?
Because I don't think I'm capable. I'm certainly not smart enough to conceptualize the vastness of space. And it does make me anxious. It made me really anxious as a kid. I'm getting better now, but I remember sitting at the table and my dad just said, and he obviously was thinking about it, he goes, the universe is ever expanding. And I said to him, into what? And he just sat there, you know, sawing into his pork chop. I don't know.
Hmm.
And you expect your parents to know everything.
Well, my turn to brag a little bit. I met Neil Turek, and then I met Stephen Hawking.
Oh, wow.
And I can tell you that those men, Neil Turek is the head of the Perimeter Institute here in Canada. Him and Stephen Hawking would like debate the, you know, the Big Bang theory. You know, they had different views of how it all got started, and they, that was their discussion, was, you know, like, and he gave me his book. Neil wrote a book, and he gave me his book, and his book, I Anil, if you're listening, I think you definitely are one of the smartest humans I've ever met in my entire life, you and Stephen.
Let's come back to that.
We'll come back. So Neil Turek is a South African. So the first time I met him, he was just very quiet. I didn't know who he was. I met him at an event. He started talking to me, and we started talking about, you know, kind of everything. We were at an event for something to do with the Perimeter Institute, I think it was. No, we were at a gala of some sort, and I got introduced to him. And of course, he's South African, so
that's
was
so
what
great.
We had in connection. And we started talking, and he.
Arlene is South African.
I'm South African. He specializes in mathematical physics and early universe physics, including the cosmological constant and a cycle model for the universe.
I have no idea what you just said to me.
Exactly. But he's an amazing man. I just want to read to you. He was born in Johannesburg, and he did a postdoctoral at Santa Barbara. He was an associate scientist at Fermilab, Illinois. He was awarded the Maxwell Medal of the Institute of Physics for his contributions to theoretical physics. He was 1994, he was appointed professor of physics at Princeton University. He held the chair of mathematical physics at the University of Cambridge, and then he was appointed director of the Perimeter Institute in 2006.
Arlene, I finished high school, okay? Give me a break.
This guy, not only, you know what I love about him and what I, I got to meet Stephen Hawking through him. And
The same night?
Different times. I met Stephen at a different event later on, and Stephen had a sense of humor. He was
a ladies' man.
He was also he would look at you and you just felt like he was seeing right through you. It was an interesting. He had an amazing. You just knew you were looking at intellect, and he had a sense of humor, and he was, you know, he was a bit of a flirt, but he was such a interesting. It was such an amazing moment. I'm not doing it justice
to say
what it meant to meet him, because it was really quite amazing. And Neil, what I love about people who are incredibly intelligent, such as those Stephen was and Neil is they can take complex ideas and bring them down to a place where you can understand the essence of what they're trying to solve. And it's really fascinating. And I got a chance, because of meeting them, I got a chance to do The Current. I got guest hosted for The Current one time. And I went actually out to the Perimeter Institute, which is an amazing institute.
Where is that located?
It's just in Waterloo. And it's really quite an incredible place. And it's a big institute with walls and chalkboards, and everybody can, you know, kind of write down things and thoughts with chalk. It's really amazing. And I got to interview, the head of the founder of BlackBerry, and I got to talk to these physicists. You know, I'm a string physicist. These people are brilliant. Anyway,
but you're right. Just simplifying ideas.
Point. Simplifying ideas is really what they are very, very good at. And I always say, if somebody makes you feel stupid because they're telling you, trying to explain a complex thought, and they're acting and they can't explain it in a simple way, then it's not you that's stupid. It's their ability to explain themselves that's the problem.
On the heels of that,
should I make any?
No,
sense
absolutely. But on the heels of that statement, when you talk about super intelligent people making things very simple, it's fascinating to me, because it's very much that way in the arts, and you know that. When you have someone coming in to do a pitch, like even the years and years of Dragon's Den, seeing people come in and they have these ideas, whether they're complex ideas or simple ideas or a pet rock or whatever the idea is, I think you will agree that, like with my television show, people are like, what is the show about? I need to be able to say, in one or two sentences, this is what this television show is about.
Yeah.
If it takes me three paragraphs, I'm lost in it. And I think you'd agree, when you have inventors standing, entrepreneurs standing in front of you, entrepreneurs, you know that it has to be simple.
Yeah. Well, when you look, you make a really good point, because when you go into a museum and you'll see some very contemporary art in particular, where it's maybe it's a red line on a white canvas, and you go, oh, I could do that. Well, actually, No, you couldn't, because it takes a specific type of vision and expression to be able to get to that canvas. And people who think, you know, creating art is easy, people who think that, you know, the simplistic, you know, when you look at folk art as an example, you know, these things are...
Contemporary folk art, like the dot on a page, that I wouldn't hang that in my home.
No, but it still takes talent.
I went to I can't remember what gallery. I have to ask Cynthia Lois what freaking gallery it was.
But in Toronto?
She told me to
AGO?
Go. I feel like, no, I think I was in London somewhere. It was a room, Cynthia, call me when you hear this podcast, when you hear this radio show, call in and tell me. It was a massive panels of red. Red panels that all look the same. So this room was, you know what those gallery rooms can be like. And it was like 10 big red panels. And each panel was named something differently. So it was lost on me. Like, I went in there and I kind of felt like a jerk, because I just kind of walked out rolling my eyeballs. But there were people standing in there gobsmacked.
It's
so wonderful. Look at this. And I'm like, everything's painted red.
Did you ever see that? Like the live installation where that woman sat on that chair and she just sat and stared at people that sat across from her. So
that
people,
made me cry.
Yes, that I was going to say. So in theory,
that went around the internet for a while.
Yes, if somebody
it was an ex-lover she hadn't seen.
Yes,
and it was like a 3-minute piece. This woman's installation was sitting at a chair at a desk, and random people came in. They sat across from her, and they looked at each other for a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
And what Arlene's speaking of is. This one thing that was making its rounds on the internet, Facebook and what have you, was an ex-partner, an ex-lover of hers, that they hadn't seen each other since they ended their relationship, and they sat there. There was no speaking. You only got to look at each other. And it made me cry.
Yeah.
Because it was intense.
Yeah, because the whole, again, the connection, the human connection, whether it's through writing where you're not speaking but you're just reading and you're evoking your own emotions, whether it's sitting looking at somebody and really truly looking
connecting.
At somebody and connecting, whether it's viewing art and
I think that's why we enjoy speaking across from each other.
Yeah, maybe because we get to see each other.
They're different programs, you know.
Yeah.
I think when we're, I mean, I don't know if people would hear the difference, but I can feel it, you know.
Yeah,
if
for
I'm,
sure.
If I'm on a ship on a river and you're in Toronto and or you're
Yeah.
It is. It's different.
But this whole show, I mean, you know, we were just commenting on the break how quickly it's gone. And I think it's gone quickly because we're talking about a subject matter that I hope our listeners will take to heart, which is that art and
we started with reading
and reading and the expression of yourself creatively is very, very important. And sharing books with your friends and talking about their meaning. And
a lot of people are doing book clubs.
Book clubs
now.
Are back in style, which I think is
Love
awesome.
It.
And I think it's very important because it gets you into a conversation just like we got into. And I think about all the and I feel blessed to have. I got to say, when I first got on an airplane. And I saw somebody reading my first book, Persuasion.
Oh.
I almost wanted to hide because I thought, did they know I'm here? Because my picture's on the cover,
yeah.
Right? And I was going, oh my God, they're reading my book.
Like, that's very cool.
Have you not ever had that experience?
No, I've never. I've only seen pictures of people taking a picture of the cover and they're on a beach somewhere.
No,
and
it's just so.
It is. It's an honor.
It's an honor.
Because it's people's time.
Yes.
And you only have so much of it.
Yeah. So all that to say that I think the show's gone fast because, A, we're together, but also because we're talking about a subject matter that I think is really important. And I'm very grateful for artists who express themselves. I'm grateful for art
life,
of any
reading.
Kind, reading.
I'll let you know how
writing.
Middlemarch goes, because probably 19 shows from now, you'll be saying to me, are you still reading George Eliot's Middlemarch? And I'll be like, yes, I've got 400 pages to go.
Yeah, but you read 100 pages in a night.
Oh,
that's a
I
lot.
I was so fascinated by the language, by the history, and then I kept stopping and looking things up. Like, they would talk about something, George Eliot would talk about something in the book, and I'm like, I don't even know what that is.
And you'd have to go back.
And they were referring to, like, a piece of clothing on the woman's skirt, and they were referring to it in the book, but I didn't know what it was. I thought, is it a purse? What's and so I'd look that up. And
I always like the books where they have these, they're created and kind of mythical lands, and they create little maps inside the book, and the mythical land is all outlined on a geography.
Well, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, Lord of the Rings, and then you're reading the book, and you say, and they're in there, and then you have to flip back to find out, where's that, or who's that character, because they line up all the characters at the beginning, so you can go like a, you know, check back, because you get so lost in it. Who was that person again, and where was that again, and how far is that?
If you've ever read any of the Game of Thrones stuff, if you've ever read the...
I've not even watched the show.
Oh, my gosh. Well, when I first started reading those books, I mean, that's a perfect example. I was like, who the hell is this guy?
Yeah.
Like, reading the books was a real slog for me. I hadn't read a lot of that kind of genre. But as you know, or don't know, because you've never seen it, there's a lot of families, a lot of characters, a lot of different places where it takes place. But boy, that really challenged my thinking.
Well, and it's like, remember Isaac Asimov, who wrote all the science fiction? And I bet you 90% of that stuff has come true, though. I think they're kind of prescient. These science fiction writers, they can see, it's almost like they can see the future, because often the things that they imagine come to fruition in some way, you know, like they talk about things at the time you read it in the 50s, you go, oh, that's never going to happen. They go, oh my gosh, we flew past that.
The Jetsons cartoon, when they looked at their wrists.
Yes, the Jetsons.
And saw, I love the Jetsons. And they did phone calls, and they're looking, you know, they're talking to each other on their phone. Well, that's reality.
The microwave, basically, is what they were, you know, for their food.
But doing FaceTime, doesn't that ever boggle your mind? I'll talk to my friend in the UK once a week. And I'm just like, this isn't costing us really anything, Nigel, except our paying our Wi-Fi services. And I am speaking to you from thousands of kilometers away, and we're talking in real time.
I love.
And
he took me on a
tour of his garden yesterday.
That's very cool.
And took the iPad and walked around and showed me all his plants.
That's
and
cool.
I just can't even get my head around it.
It was the Jetsons. I loved the Jetsons. I loved the Jetsons.
Well,
I
look at the Jetsons again, because a lot of the stuff
maid's
they
name?
Did.
What was the maid's name? The robot that was the, that, you know, I could see a little apron around her, and she was always, Rosie.
Then there's Judy.
It was Rosie.
I love Judy.
There was Rosie. There was Jane.
Yeah.
Jane.
The mom.
That mom, Judy. There was
Judy the kid,
Elroy,
the teenager, Elroy,
Astro,
the little guy,
was the little dog,
the dog.
There was George Jetson. There was Henry.
I can remember the song.
Anyway, yeah.
We're going to come back and talk more about your favorite 1950s, 60s shows.
Aren't we done? Oh, we're done.
No.
We're going to come back another time. So,
my gosh.
Talk to your friends, and little time will fly, and read a book, and go watch the Jetsons for those of you who don't know what the hell we're talking about.
Yeah. Anyway, good to talk to you, Arlene.
Nice to talk to you. See you soon. La, la, la.